Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Welcome to Current State on WKAR. It's 3-1-1-1-3. The day we pay our daylight savings time dues, right? 6:45 a.m. was tougher this morning than it has been recently. But won't 6:45 p.m. be worth it? Sure it will. First the famine, then the feast. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here. From a controversial call over a Detroit emergency manager to the politics of road funding, to a call by Democrats to make college tuition available to all state high school graduates, Governor Rick Snyder had a lot going on late last week. Still, late on Friday, I managed to catch up with the governor for just a few minutes by phone for a quick update on all these issues. I first asked him what he's considering offering Democrats in exchange for more support on his billion-dollar-plus road funding measure.
Well, what I'd like to see happen on the road measure is I would really appreciate if both the Democratic House members and the Democratic Senate members would come forward with their plans, what they think would be good plans to address this issue. Again, in a perfect world, I'd like to have both parties and both chambers all put together four different versions of plans to go along with the plan we put. Let's get them all on the table and let's talk.
Last week, they announced that their Michigan 2020 tuition plan, college tuition plan, is their top legislative priority. To what extent could you get behind that?
Well, again, we've got a lot of important efforts already on the question of not just college, but careers, because it should be about getting a university degree, particularly in the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. Well, I don't want to overlook the skilled trades, all the great community college opportunities for specialized training, because there's fabulous jobs there. So it's to focus on both those areas in a way that I believe a lot of us want to see the improvements in Michigan, and that goes right back to those summits we were talking about.
The 2020 plan relies on apparently $2 billion worth of expendable loopholes in the budget. Are there $2 billion worth of expendable loopholes in the state budget?
Well, I think we need to be very thoughtful about that, because when we got rid of the Michigan business tax, I can tell you, I was very clear. I wiped out most corporate loopholes, just blew them off the map because I don't believe in them, largely. So we cleaned up most of that. So a lot of what you would describe as a tax expenditure that are left are things that I'm not sure there are things people would really want to do. For example, that's where you start getting the concept of sales tax on a lot of services.
Is there anything that might happen now that would persuade you not to appoint an emergency manager in Detroit?
Well, again, there's an appeals period, so I would say I'm open-minded. The appeal hearing is set for Tuesday morning, and I also have made it clear outside the technical appeals process, if city council or the mayor have something else they want to share that they want me to consider, I'm happy to do that outside the appeals process, even as long as I can get it by 5 on Monday.
So your mind is still open. Your mind's not made up necessarily.
No, I would say it's a challenging environment. I mean, it would have to be something truly compelling given the track record here, but I'm open-minded.
Like what? What would be truly compelling to you?
Well, that's why I'm waiting to see what they submit, because this shouldn't be something I create. This should be something that, again, the people that want to have that responsibility, that option, should be bringing forward, and I'm happy to review it.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Then part of the American frontier, the territory that we now call the state of Michigan, was the scene of many important battles during the War of 1812. And today, the Michigan War of 1812 Bicentennial Commission meets to discuss commemorations of Michigan's historic role in that war, and here to tell us more about what's on tap and to help recount some of Michigan's most memorable moments from the war is Sandra Clark. Sandra's the director of the Michigan Historical Museum. Thanks for coming in today.
Glad to do it.
Nice to see you. Commemorating the bicentennial of the War of 1812 arguably may have made a little more sense a few months back, but...
it's still going on.
The war lasted a while, as it turns out. It's the only war we've fought with a year in it, you know,
yes.
Right? So, I mean, people think, you know, the bicentennial should have been last year. But as it turns out, Michigan is marking bicentennial events related to the war, not only this year, but into 2014 as well. Remind us, what was at stake in the War of 1812, and what triggered this conflict?
It's really, you have to kind of remember how recent the American Revolution was. It's 30 years after the peace. And America's still a little bit of a tenuous operation. So for the United States, this is really its assertion that, yes, it is a nation. It's a nation to be dealt with. It's there up until the War of 1812, the fur traders up in Mackinac, coming out of Montreal to Mackinac, are petitioning every year to the British government to take Michigan back.
Okay.
So for Michigan, this makes sure that we are part of the United States. Canadians take great pride in the war because they resisted American invasion.
Okay.
And, of course, the third party in the war is the Native Americans. And for them, the United States and Canada both thought they won the war in some ways, the Native Americans really lose the war.
But was there this feeling then that the British never should have lost the Revolutionary War? Was that sentiment in play?
I don't know if so much that sentiment, but I think there's real resistance. The British are in Michigan until 1796.
Okay.
They don't even evacuate the forts here. So it's 20 years. They're still trading with Michigan Indians.
It was the frontier.
It's
it was
the frontier.
Impossible to control, right?
And the Native Americans are trying to preserve their homeland, so they are attacking United States settlements.
Okay.
And the United States is pretty sure the British are on the side of the Native Americans. And there's also this business of impressment at sea and things like that, although I think it's really the frontier that's in many ways the cause of the war. When the United States voted to declare war, New England, which was where all the merchant folks were, did not vote to declare war. It was the southern and western states that voted to declare war in the War of 1812, and it was because of this frontier conflict with the Native Americans and the belief that the British were helping them.
So it was important to secure the frontier.
Exactly.
It was important to secure Michigan.
Exactly.
Surrounded by water.
Exactly.
Is that the deal? So all during the war, we were a territory, not a state. We were kind of like Texas.
Well, in a way, yes.
The champions of the West, right?
We are the West.
We're the West
we
in 1812.
West. Yes, we are the West. And we are on a frontier, you know, 200 years ago today, Detroit was governed by Britain and by the Canadians because we had lost Detroit the year before. And when we talk about the River Raisin Battle, which happened 200 years ago just this January, we're talking about the United States sending troops north to retake Detroit and not making it.
Tell us a little bit more about that Battle of Detroit.
The Battle of Detroit is very early in the war. Hull was a territorial governor. He gets convinced that he's the military commander as well. He comes north from Cincinnati. He has to build the road to bring the supplies as he's coming back to Detroit.
Oh, my.
Hull's Trace, to get to connect for all the way up here to get a supply route, they're actually cutting down trees and building road as they come.
Hull's Trace.
It was called Hull's Trace. There's still some logs that you can see from that road if you know the right place to look, and there's a historical marker between Detroit and Monroe.
Okay.
Yeah. So Hull is in Detroit. He's invaded Canada. He's come back to this side of the river. And he gets invaded by the British and their Indian allies and the Canadian militia. This is in 1812. Mackinac has already fallen to the British, and he's terribly frightened. His family is with him. Detroit's a pretty civilized place in many ways. He's afraid of what the Indians may do, and without much of a fight, he surrenders Detroit to the British. And so the British are in control of Detroit for the better part of a year. They finally, this year, 1813, is the year when Perry's victory down on Lake Erie over the British opens up the Great Lakes, gives the United States control of the Great Lakes, and that's when it becomes possible to control Detroit again.
A linchpin battle then?
Yes.
Commodore Perry? Do
Commodore Perry.
Commodore Perry, yes.
We have met the enemy, and they are ours.
Oh, how about that?
That one.
tell us a little bit more about that then.
That's, as I said, it's on Lake Erie. The American ships managed to outflank the British frigates and managed to take them. And, you know, Hull said all along, if you can't give me supplies, I can't hold Detroit, I can't hold this territory. And he was very correct.
Do you have do we have a sense for how much awareness there was? I mean, so much of America, as we've said, was mm-hmm. frontier then. Was there a common awareness of the conflict? Were people staying on top of it? Do we know?
I think they were. The United States had a plan. They were going to invade Canada at Detroit, at Niagara, and up through New York. And they were going to take Canada and use that to force the British to do what they wanted them to do. I don't know if they ever thought they were going to hold all that territory, but they certainly, that was their plan. So Detroit is very key to that. And certainly people all along the Detroit River were very much involved in this war because the Detroit River is so easy to cross, especially mm-hmm. in small boats and canoes. So there are countless skirmishes, small battles along that frontier. And eventually there is the Battle of the Thames in Canada, where the United States goes into Canada from the Detroit River and defeats the British, defeats Tecumseh, the Native American leader that was allied with the British, dies in that battle.
In the time we have left, cover the highlights of what the Commission has planned for the rest of this year and into 2014.
They have an international symposium October 13th in Detroit on the war. They're planning another scholarly meeting for 2014 and a celebration of the end of the war in 2015. I think one of the interesting things that they're also supporting, because they're supporting a lot of local efforts, is a exhibit up in Harbor Springs this summer that is the Native American perspective on the War of 1812, because they are the third party in all of this. And by allying with the British, by allying with the side that lost in at least in Michigan, it's really the end of their effort to resist and protect their homelands through battle.
Do you think more Michiganians will learn more about the War of 1812 here because of what you've got planned? This is an awful fuzzy war in our history.
It is. It's something that's caught between the American Revolution and the Civil War, and
right.
We ignore it. We certainly hope they're going to learn a little bit more about it because Michigan's a very important part of it.
Sandra Clark is the director of the Michigan Historical Museum. Thanks for joining me to talk about Michigan's role in the War of 1812.
I've enjoyed it.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The country's top comedians are appearing in Grand Rapids through Sunday at Gilda's Laugh Fest. The event supports the work of Gilda's Club of Grand Rapids, inspired by the late Gilda Radner to help people who are dealing with cancer. Tonight at 8 p.m., the festival features W. Kamau Bell. He's the host of a show called Totally Biased. Seen Thursday nights on FX, he calls his performance the W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in 1 Hour. I mentioned to Bell that might have a lot of people looking forward to 9 p.m. tonight.
Me too.
What do you do in the show?
Time for this racism to be over.
What do you do in the show?
Tell jokes. You know, it's about an hour long, and I go through it's a lot of pop culture and topical stuff and a little bit of unknown history, and all with the goal of ending racism hilariously. Which, you know, Martin Luther King tried to end racism, but he didn't do it hilariously, so, you know. I am better than him, is all I'm saying.
One of America's top comedians and actors, Chris Rock, was instrumental in getting you on television. He's the executive producer of Totally Biased and has appeared on the show. How did that come about?
You know, it sounds, when you tell it too quickly, it sounds like it was really easy, but it was just, you know, I knew a couple key people who knew him, And they had seen my show. One of them is Chuck Sklar, who's now an executive producer on the show, and one is Jocelyn Cooper, who runs a website called Afropunk. And they both knew him and apparently got in his ear and told him he needed to see my live show, The WCOM Bell Curve. And so at one point I did it in New York, and it was a good show. I did it at the UCB Theater, and then afterwards I was backstage, and he sort of floated backstage on a cloud and, you know, all dressed in black like it was The Matrix, and told me he thought I was funny. And then a couple months later, he called me up and said he wanted to try to do a TV show with me, which I didn't know what that meant, but here we are.
Well, Totally Biased has a lot of political humor, and you have a liberal approach to most topics.
I've been accused of being a liberal, yes.
Do you hear from viewers who are conservative as well as liberal?
I do hear from viewers who are conservative, and I think sometimes, you know, certainly there's people who don't like me who are on both sides of the aisle, and there's also people who like me on both sides of the aisle. I've heard from some conservative people that they like the show. So I think it's,
how do you,
you know,
feel
we're
about
not,
that? How do you feel about that?
You know, I feel good. It feels like it makes sense what I'm talking about. Like, you know, like, I'm not trying to rep the Democratic Party. I'm just trying to rep the things that I think make sense. And so I don't think making sense is wholly one party's, you know, bailiwick. As we can see from the whole breakdown of the sequester, clearly both people can be filled with nonsense.
Well, we want a healthy two-party system, right? Isn't that
or a healthy system? I don't think a number of parties is a doesn't have to be just two parties. Certainly, other countries have more than two and seem to figure out how to do it. So, I think we just want a healthy system.
You may be liberal, but that doesn't mean you support President Obama all the time.
The Obama administration is under fire this week after a leaked Justice Department memo said that the government is allowed to kill U.S. citizens living abroad based only on the suspicion that they're quote-unquote imminent threats. So, can we define an imminent threat, please?
Imminence does not mean that the United States has to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons or interests is underway.
Oh, so they don't need evidence to kill people. So what the administration means by imminent threat is that the administration is an imminent threat. Somewhere the Nobel Committee is going, which one of us is going to ask President Obama to return that Peace Prize? I mean, they made Milli Vanilli give back that Grammy.
No, I mean, you know, that's the thing. I certainly voted for Obama twice, but that doesn't, just because you vote for somebody doesn't mean you have to go along with everything they say and do. So I think that, you know, I think the problem is with this country is that the right gets so extreme sometimes that you feel like, I would like to criticize Obama, but I'm afraid if I do, I'm going to end up with a Tea Party rally leaping up behind me. So I got to be careful.
Racial dynamics are a big part of the show. You're an African-American guy with a white wife and a biracial.
No, I'm a black guy. I'm a black guy.
You're a black guy. Black, not an African-American. Okay.
No. That sounds like I'm about to go to court. I'd like to be a black guy.
Okay. With a white wife and a biracial child, a life that gives you a variety of perspectives on race in this country.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're going to end racism, you might as well get in the thick of it and try to bring all the races together personally. So, yeah, so... You know, I'm a black guy with white in-laws, and the only thing that makes having in-laws harder is making them a different race than you. So, like, I think that, you know, I'm in the middle of it, and that's why the show. And I lived in San Francisco for 15 years, which is a hotbed of lots of different things. So, I feel like that all sort of stewed my perspective.
Last month, Forrest Whitaker, the black actor known for a lot of great roles, perhaps best known for Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland, was stopped and frisked at a deli in Manhattan. Apparently, an employee thought he'd shoplifted something, which he hadn't.
Yogurt, which is not, I don't know, on the list of things that shoplifters tend to shoplift, I think yogurt is pretty low on that list, but continue.
What did you make of that?
Well, you know, I think that, sadly, you know, the thing that I made of is that, oh, you can't be famous enough to not be racially profiled. Like, you know, like, he has an Academy Award. You would think that would make him famous enough to not be racially profiled. And I sort of feel like if we're going to continue to racially profile people, we should at least put a list together of these are the black people you shouldn't racially profile. Oscar winners, Nobel Prize winners, presidents, you know, like I just feel like, so that they can at least get through their day. Me, I understand. I'm a lowly late night cable show host. I'll still take some racial profiling, but we should allow a few people out of that ridiculous nonsense.
Now, at a lot of your live performances, you seek out a multiracial audience by offering buy one, get one free ticketing to people who bring a friend of a different race.
Absolutely.
How would you describe the audiences that idea produces, and will you be doing that in Grand Rapids tonight?
I think we're doing it through the festival, so I don't know that we are doing it because we're doing it through the festival that's happening there. But when I do that, it definitely changes the makeup of the audience. You get a little bit of everybody, which is great, because I think the only way to end racism is to actually get everybody in the room. You know, I think we all need to have our separate meetings where we talk about stuff and air grievances, but if we're actually going to end racism, we need to get at least, it's like Noah's Ark. We need two of everybody.
Well, at the risk of getting a little heavy here on you, do you view your comedy more as activism or more as therapy? I mean, people come to laugh.
That's funny. I didn't guess you're going to say therapy, but yes.
Well, I mean, that's what good comedy is. Hopefully, it's thought provoking. But is it more of one than the other? More activism or more therapy?
No. I mean, you know, people have called me an activist. I think even my bio has called me an activist because I didn't write it. But I think activism is a very specific thing. It's like, you know, it's getting up early. I mean, it can happen either in the streets or on your computer, but it's really a big job, and I wouldn't want to say that. I think comedy can sort of help fuel the fires of activism if it's good, and also can fuel the fires of activism if it's really, really bad. But, you know, I don't think that the comedy, I wouldn't describe it as activism, because ultimately on stage, I'm trying to get the same big, healthy gut laughs that every comedian's trying to get. And if I forget to do that, then it suddenly becomes just a really poorly researched speech.
Man on the Street segments are a big part of Totally Biased. Lots of, or a number of show hosts do that, notably Jay Leno.
So here's my issue. I'll show you a picture of my daughter. Oh, yeah, that's her.
Oh, beautiful.
And she, like Barack Obama, is mixed race.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, my wife is white.
Okay.
I'm a black dude. Is that cool?
I can tell a little bit,
it's got a little tense.
You couldn't find no nice coordinated sister like myself for your brother?
So this is my daughter. She's a mixed race kid. My wife's white. We got so excited about Barack Obama, mixed race dude, that we decided to get a mixed race baby.
Let me ask you this. Is she white like Angelina Jolie white, or is she white like the late Anna Nicole Smith white?
Those are the two different whiteness?
Yeah, that's the two different
Angelina
whiteness.
Angelina Jolie, that's the two whiteness categories that you're from?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with she's Angelina Jolie white.
All right, well then, yeah, you know, okay. That's
how have you made these segments your own?
Well, it's funny. This is the first time I've ever been in any way compared to Jay Leno. I went a long time without that. I think the thing that I do, and I think there's a lot of different ways to do Man on the Street segments. I just, in general, don't like when people try to stop me and make me do things when I'm walking down the street. So I feel like if I'm going to do that to other people, I'm going to at least give them their say. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, sure.
Like, I feel like if I stopped you, I'm going to treat you well. Because even if we disagree, let's have a conversation. Because I appreciate the fact that you stopped to talk to me. Because you didn't have to. You were doing things. We had a producer get in your face. So I just feel like even if I disagree with you, let's have a good conversation and I'll respect you and we can make fun of the issue without me needing to make fun of you.
That's real considerate, I think. That's
yeah,
cool.
And I mean, and sometimes people make fun of themselves, which is like that's their prerogative. You know, we had a 50-year-old woman, white woman who wanted to rap Tupac, and I was like, well, you've decided to do this, I'm going to let you do this. But you know, a lot of times the laughter in those segments comes out of me and the person discovering something as we talk.
How did you end up in this place? Did you want to be a stand-up comedian for a long time since you were a kid or anything like that?
No, I always wanted to be a stand-up comic. That was the once I realized, like as I've said before, once I realized that superhero wasn't actually a job option, I decided I wanted to be a stand-up comic.
Each episode of the show includes an interview segment. Are there any guests that you consider especially memorable?
Oh, I mean, our last episode of this, of our season, of, you know, we're still in the middle of season one, but our last episode was Don Cheadle, and he was amazing. I mean, it was the first time we got an A-list actor, and I'm not even sure how we got him, you know, but we got him, and we let him go. But, you know, he was really came to play and had a good time, and we had a really good conversation, and, you know, I just never imagined that, you know, he would want to be on the show and that he would come really wanting to have a good time. I mean, at one point he got up and walked out of the interview because I referenced the fact that he hadn't won an Oscar yet. So, you know, so, I mean, that was a really fun moment. And, I mean, so that one was really special. That was the last one I did. But, you know, a lot of the interviews have been great. You know, you know, the second episode, the first episode we had Chris Rock as the interview, which was a little bit cheating because he was, you know, standing next to me the whole week.
Yeah.
But the second show we had Rachel Maddow, and she was amazing. And again, we were nothing. We had just barely started, and she decided to, she heard about it from one of the people who worked on our show, and she came by and did it. And so I think that really, like, legitimized us in a way.
You know, since Cheadle hasn't won an Oscar, he's still subject to getting frisked, I guess.
Yes. We haven't put the list together yet. So even if he does win an Oscar, he's subject to getting frisked. We need to put that list together. Me and you will work on that.
Who's on your wish list of people you'd like to get
Denzel
on the
Washington.
Show? Denzel Washington.
Yes, Denzel Washington.
How come?
I'm a huge fan of his, and I'm of the age that I sort of feel like I've grown up with him as an extra dad. And I just think that he's probably the last African-American actor in Hollywood who's going to have to carry that, that baton of I'm America's black actor. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Like, Sidney Poitier passed it to him, and he is sort of like, he's still holding on to it, but it's like Will Smith's a big actor, but he doesn't have to carry it in that same way. And so I feel like Denzel's really a connection to another time in Hollywood and clearly takes it seriously. And I think, you know, I see him on talk shows all the time, and he's a really funny guy, but I would love to actually talk to him about that stuff too.
Back to Chris Rock for 1 minute. Does his acting career give you thoughts of acting yourself?
You know, man, I gotta learn how to do this TV show first. Like, I feel like people have asked me occasionally, like, oh, what do you want to get into acting? It's like, I want to stay on television, you know. So I think that, you know, if this keeps going the way it's going and we stay on the air, we have 7 more episodes starting May 9th, and then, you know, if they pick us up, we come back later. You know, I really, at this point, you know, I'm a pretty singularly focused person, and like, it's really important to me that this show sort of digs in and becomes a part of the national conversation. And if that point that happens, then maybe I'll look into movies. But right now, I'm really focused on the show.
W. Kamau Bell, star of FX's Totally Biased. He's performing tonight in Grand Rapids at Gilda's Laugh Fest. It's the W. Kamau Bell Curve, ending racism in 1 hour. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. An impressive group of Lansing and Jackson area musicians are back home after a once-in-a-lifetime journey to Italy. About 25 members of the St. Mary's Cathedral Choir of Lansing and several members of St. Mary's and St. Sands in Jackson performed 3 different times over the last couple of weeks in Italy, in Florence and in Assisi. They then performed in Rome at a mass at St. Peter's Basilica. It's a pleasure to welcome back home 2 members of Lansing St. Mary's Choir, Turney and Jeannie Gratz, along with Monsignor Stephen Rica, Chancellor of the Diocese of Lansing, who was also on the trip. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
Nice to be back home.
Morning.
Yes, it is.
Delightful to be back.
It was nice to leave, and it's nice to get back home.
Always good to be back home.
Sign of a good vacation. Turney and Jeannie, how long had this visit been planned?
Our choir director, Dr. Timothy Flynn, started the planning about a year and a half ago, gathered a few of us and said, what do you think? What do you think about a Peter's Way tour to Italy? So we got very excited about it, and off we went a week ago.
And how long had you been performing the music that you were going to perform in Italy, Turney?
Well, I only sing in the bathroom and the car, so Jeannie's the choir member. I went along as a roadie.
Okay. How long had you performed the pieces then? Did you have a year or thereabouts?
I've been part of the choir for over 3 years, and we've been working on the music for the past year with the Jackson folks. We'd get together and have several rehearsals. Some of the pieces we've performed at the cathedral as a cathedral choir, and then we practiced with the Jackson group in preparation for the trip.
Okay. And how many pieces were you prepared to perform in Italy?
I believe
about
half a dozen, four to six pieces.
And you had no way of knowing way back then that all of this drama involving a new pontiff would be unfolding while you were there.
That's correct.
Extraordinary. And you performed in 3 different locations. Do I have that right? Florence, Assisi, and Rome?
Yes.
Okay. Father Stephen, you have a history of working at the Vatican, which I gather is part of the reason that you were part of the trip. Tell us about that.
I was a student in Rome from 1988 to 91, then again 93 to 95, where I completed a doctorate at the Pontifical Gregorian University, and then was invited back by was Monsignor Timothy Dolan in those days, who now is the Cardinal Archbishop of New York, to serve as the superior director of the House of Residence for priests at the North American College who are involved in studies. And so I was involved both in their capacity to engage in studies and then to connect them with the various universities and institutes to help them obtain their degrees to prepare them to come back to serve in the United States.
Okay.
So
he must have been a pretty good tour guide to have along on the trip,
wonderful.
I would imagine, Jeannie.
Yes, we had a lot of good tour guides, but it was just real personal to have Monsignor with us, too, because he shared lots of extra little pieces along the way.
So all of a sudden, we're looking at a new pope. What happens to Italy under these circumstances? It creates quite a buzz all around the world, but what happens in Italy, Father Stephen?
There is an enormous enthusiasm that's going on, as I recall. Even when I was there in 2005 for the last events that occurred, both the funeral of John Paul II and Benedict, and the appointment of Benedict the 16th, there was tremendous curiosity, interest. The newspapers, televisions, and everybody were actively involved. And we saw this past Sunday when all the cardinals went to their own parishes in Rome, that enthusiasm that was generated even among parishioners, each kind of rooting for their own cardinal who was the titular of their particular parish, where the cardinals can act as parish priests for a weekend to be with those people of the Diocese of Rome. We had a tour guide whose name was Massimo, and he was telling us, he said, you know, during this time between pontiffs, he said, you're looking for a new pope, but we're looking for a bishop. And the windows, the pontifical, the apostolic palace where the pope resides, typically the windows are lit. He said, they're not lit, and we kind of feel an emptiness and a void. And so we're looking for this to get resolved too, because we very much want to have that point of reference, that person in town that mm-hmm. for us is a very significant figure in our life.
Jeannie Gratz, did performing in these circumstances, in these cathedrals, did this bring out your best, or were nerves a particular problem?
Oh, I think it brought out our best. It was actually overwhelming. I wasn't prepared for the emotional piece to this. I was excited about the trip. I knew that we'd see lots of things, lots of places that we've read about or seen on TV. But I wasn't prepared for the emotional piece of being able to sing in these huge basilicas with the huge domes and your voices just resonate. It was emotional for a lot of us. Yeah, brought tears.
Well, did you view this essentially as a spiritual journey, a musical journey,
a
cultural journey, or was it just
a
mess of all of those?
All of the above. It was wonderful.
Tell us.
Also a history trip, too.
A history.
We go back thousands of years.
That's right. A history trip, a reminder of all those things we learned in college.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
In humanities class.
In humanities class, right.
That's right.
And now these things just come to life again, just leap off the page from what we remember in class, humanities class, and now we're seeing them in situ and in the context in which they were.
Exactly. Tell us about your impressions of Italy outside of Rome. We'll save Rome and St. Peter's for the end. What about Florence and Assisi, Jeannie?
Well, Assisi particularly had a special place for both Turney and me. We were former Holy Cross parishioners, which was a Franciscan parish. So those are our connections. And so I think Assisi had special meaning for us, being with the Franciscans.
Okay. Florence, there's a lot to do in Florence, a lot to see, a lot of culture and history there.
Right, right. It was neat to go into the Accademia and see a lot of artwork, see the famous Michelangelo's David.
Sure.
We walked around a lot that afternoon with Monsignor, and he was able to just tour us around a little bit and give us a flavor of the city. It's very exciting.
Was there a lot of running around related to your performances, or did you have adequate time to really sightsee and such?
Oh, yeah, we had plenty of time to sightsee as well. Yeah, good combination.
Yeah. Father Stephen, tell us more about the significance of this extraordinary ritual that we are about to witness yet again, selecting a new pope. What significance does that have for you as somebody who lived in Rome for so many years?
I think there's a great fascination, obviously, with the person who is identified as the pontiff. For me, it's the election of our pastor. It's the determination of who our chief pastor is. And we're certainly hoping that as a result of all the conversations that are going on among the cardinals right now, and that as they enter into the conclave tomorrow afternoon, that that they are going to look at the global perspective of who we are, the Catholicity, the universality of who we are,
right.
And to select that person that might, but indeed will be the best person with all of his gifts and perhaps even with some of his flaws to be able to lead us to get to know Christ, our Lord and Savior, just a little bit better. And I hope that that person will be well-grounded in faith, have a beautiful witness to that relationship that he has with our Lord, and can certainly guide us in the problems and the issues that we continue to face, but also to get to know and meet Christ in a very personal way.
Attorney and Jeannie Gratz are members of the St. Mary's Choir of Lansing. They are just amongst a group of about 25 singers from that choir and others in the Jackson area who are just back from their trip to Italy. Monsignor Stephen Rica is Chancellor of the Diocese of Lansing, who is also on the trip. Many thanks and welcome home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Its current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. We've got Joe Rexroad of the Detroit Free Press ready to deconstruct a very busy late Sunday here in Big Ten basketball. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. In the end, MSU was relying on Michigan in the Indiana game to improve our fortunes. There was a ton of drama at the end, but it was not to be. Let's recap yesterday. First of all, what did you make of our outing against Northwestern?
Well, it was clear in the building and on the court that there was a severe lack of energy. And I'm not sure exactly at what moment the Michigan State players found out about the Michigan score, but it was 22-9 Michigan State at one point, and soon after that, it just seemed like, the air was let out. I mean, Derek Nix said in the huddle that Tom Izzo, you got to help me out here, because he was, distraught when he found out Michigan had lost. I mean, these guys really hoped that Michigan would win and that they would be playing for a championship. So it took Izzo, kind of a fiery halftime speech, sort of the same speech I think that he gave at the end of the game, which was, we don't need anything from anyone. And, of course, it was a very fiery speech, got the crowd fired up afterward, and that's kind of what he tried at the half to, get his team to start playing again. And, it was a tie game with 5 minutes and change left to go, which was very surprising.
How often is the team in these extraordinary circumstances? They find out during a game that another critical game has turned against them. That can't happen too often, can it?
I cannot recall a situation exactly like this. There have certainly been days. I mean, a year ago was sort of the reverse, with Michigan rooting for Ohio State to win at Michigan State, which did happen, and of course that allowed all three teams to have the title. Ohio State and Michigan were able to share it with Michigan State. I can't remember a situation where another game was sort of just ending as a team was starting its game, and it's players are sort of finding out. Of course you're going to find out. Everyone has phones. It was never announced in the arena, but apparently Russell Bird told some of his teammates he heard it from someone in the crowd, and of course it spread through the locker room. So, yeah, I can't remember a situation exactly like this.
And the Michigan-Indiana contest, what do you take away from that?
Well, I wish I could have seen the end, but I had to cover the Michigan State game.
Right.
So I'm following along on GameCast, and of course I saw the highlights later, but I was stunned, of course. Michigan's up 5 with 40 seconds to go, and it's like, well, it's over. This is going to be for a banner. All of a sudden it's like, oh, there's a miss. Missed free throw. Pretty amazing. I mean, really a lot like Indiana's win at Michigan State back on February 19th. Michigan State had a chance at the free throw line to put that game away and didn't. And same thing with Michigan yesterday. Michigan's two best players, Trey Burke and Tim Hardaway Jr., both miss 1-on-1 free throw opportunities, allowing that to happen. Of course, I'm sure you saw the end, the amazing ball hanging on the rim and falling off. So Indiana earned that Big Ten championship by winning at Michigan, at Ohio State, and at Michigan State.
And how do you assess Michigan State here on the threshold of the Big Ten tournament?
Well, I would not use yesterday as any sort of gauge for how this team is playing or going to play. I really think that was an emotionally difficult situation. I think this team has a chance to do very well in the postseason if everything comes together. Travis Trice getting back now and playing more is good for this team. I think there's enough depth now up front and on the perimeter to be able to handle a weekend like what may happen here in Chicago if the Spartans win multiple games. I think they've got enough depth to get through that. And I think this team has a real chance to be Izzo's seventh Final Four team. And when you look around college basketball, there really is not a dominant team. So I look at Michigan State as having just about as good a chance as anyone to win a national championship.
And the Spartans now face the winner of the Iowa-Northwestern game on Friday night, as I recall. Your column today is a look back on the Big Ten regular season. What is your – tell us about your overview.
Well, I think it's – I don't want to – you know, people debate – best eras. Some say, you know, the late 80s was the best time for the Big Ten. And, of course, Magic Johnson a couple weeks ago said, well, it's as good as it was since my time, you know. Everyone says their time was the best. But I think this is the best Big Ten season I've ever seen. When you think about Michigan having its best team in 20 years and it's the 5 seed and doesn't even get a bye on the first day, think about Illinois and Minnesota are the 8 and 9. And they are going to play, they were both top 10 teams this year, and they're both almost for sure going to the NCAA tournament. So it was an amazing year. It really lived up to the hype. We'll see if the Big Ten can live up to the hype in the postseason and live up to its reputation, but it never disappointed all year. Every week there were great games, upsets, and just great teams going at each other.
The conference learns the Big Ten Player of the Year tonight, the Coach of the Year. Who do you like for Player of the Year?
Well, that was tough. I mean, we had to have our votes in by 9 last night, and, of course, I'm voting while covering the Michigan State game. And it was tough, and I did wait all the way to the end. But Victor Oladipo, to me, because he might be the most impactful defensive player in the country, I favor him. And it's tough because Trey Burke was just terrific all year. It's hard to blame Trey Burke, you know, one loss and that cost him. I don't think it's that simple. It's a whole body of work. I saw Victor Oladipo really beat Michigan State twice almost on his own. I mean, he was by far the biggest factor in both of those games. But it's a great debate because offensively Trey Burke has probably been as efficient and consistent as anyone in the country. So if either of them won Big Ten and or National Player of the Year, and I do think they're the top candidates for both awards, it's not a bad pick.
And Coach of the Year?
That is extremely difficult. I mean, Tom Crean, his team won it outright, so, you know, you could look at him, but their expectations were there. They were preseason number one. Tom Izzo did not have expectations like that, and his team, to me, overachieved relative to expectations. Thad Mott of Ohio State, also, a very good choice. Bo Ryan of Wisconsin, the injuries, and then still finishing in the top 4. That is absolutely tough to call. I'm guessing it will be Cream because of the outright title.
Joe Rexroad is with the Detroit Free Press. You also see his work in the Lansing State Journal. Joe, thank you, and we'll talk again Friday.
Sounds good, Mark. Thank you.
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. MLive's Angela Whitrock joins Current State every Monday morning for a quick look at business and development and the economy and the like. How are you?
Fabulous. How are you, Mark?
Nice to see you. Governor Snyder has an economic summit next week in Detroit that he announced last Friday. I spoke with him briefly about it. What's your take on this summit?
Well, I think it's really interesting that it seems like he's on a sort of fact-finding mission to find out what's the reason for this gap between the amount of available jobs in the state and the inability of employers to fill them. The Tom Walsh piece in the Free Press this weekend noted that the governor says there are about 62,000 jobs that are unfilled in Michigan, And that, you know, they believe it's part of a skills gap, that maybe folks are graduating school without the proper skills needed to fill these jobs. So it's a question of, I guess from their point, figuring out why is it that there are these jobs that are unfilled when we definitely have kids who are attending school and getting training. Are they, something's not lining up properly, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that, I imagine this is something all states are dealing with post-recession, perhaps? Is this, or is Michigan especially challenged by this?
You know,
this?
I think Michigan could be especially challenged because for so long the economy was so heavily dependent upon manufacturing and the auto industry. And so you could graduate high school and have a pretty solid career option.
Yeah.
You know, and as a lot of economists have mentioned, the economy itself is sort of in a transition point. You know, you're not seeing as many administrative assistant jobs, but you are, as someone noted in the Walsh column this weekend, seeing a need for app developers. So part of it is that there's always a bit of a lag, you know, between when we see these new innovations being made in the way that we operate and the way we do business and, you know, bringing the next generation of kids up who are going to do those things. In the meantime, there's always sort of a disconnect, and I think that's where we are now. And it seems like that's what Governor Snyder's attempting to target is, you know, bridging that gap and not waiting so long. I mean, Michigan really is not in a position to wait forever for this to happen. So it seems like he's trying to speed that process up a bit with this summit.
And the emphasis always seems to be on the so-called STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math. That part of, that is a big part of this conversation, right?
That is, yeah. And I think, you know, hopefully one of the things that will come out of this summit, I say as an English major and art history major in college, is that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of creativity that's required in these jobs. You're not, you know, an app developer, yes, has to have a tremendous amount of skill when it comes to coding and the really complex parts of, like, the interwebs. But you also have to have the ability to have a nimble brain and think about problem solving in a way that's not always restricted just to engineering or science or math. So I'm hopeful that someone at this summit will stand up and wave the flag and say, don't forget about being creative here.
You reported again in the last few days on MLive on the developer proposals that are being looked over in East Lansing for the Grand River Abbott area. Can you update us on that?
Yeah, so there were seven proposals that came in. The city of East Lansing issued what they call an RFQP, a very fancy way to say, we want you to give us your ideas, but only if you're qualified, please. They got seven proposals. That's down to six now. These are all for the city-owned properties that were part of City Center. So it's about 2.8 acres. Seven proposals came in. That's down to six now. Core Campus withdrew its proposals. They were attempting to negotiate with Strathmore Development Company for those three properties, the one on Evergreen and then the large bank building and the property next to it on Grand River.
Right.
They wanted to buy those and include them, basically make another City Center 2 go of it, but without the Strathmore company being involved. Those negotiations apparently fell through, and so they just withdrew their proposal wholesale. Interestingly, DTN, which is the apartment management firm that is, you know, has a huge market share here, they also have a proposal, and it was also heavily dependent upon buying those lands from Strathmore again, and those also fell through. But instead of withdrawing their proposal, they've said that they plan to submit a revised proposal. So I'm kind of watching that closely to see how that shakes out. You know, I don't know if Core Campus would have withdrawn had they known they could revise. There seems to be some hesitance on the part of some members of this review team over whether DTN should be allowed to revise their proposal. So a lot of things in the air, and this is all, you know, theoretically supposed to be settled. We're supposed to get a proposal, a recommendation, and maybe sometime something happening starting around April 25th. So not a lot of time left to really sort out these issues, like, can they do it?
Yeah. Well, Scott Chappelle, Strathmore executive, has denied in the past that he is the owner of those private properties. I think there's a company called CATA that is
right.
Officially the owner. There's some confusion there, but it would seem like whoever is the owner right. of those privately held properties really has a trump card here.
Well, and that's true. And, you know, just to be clear, what these are owned by, it's an LLC. And what that allows you to do is to put a buffer between yourself and the property. So if you wanted to form Mark Bayshore LLC and buy 12 houses on the east side of Lansing and flip them and it didn't work out well, Mark Bayshore LLC might go under, but Mark Bayshore radio host would be okay.
Okay.
So, and then I could invest in your LLC and we could say, well, we don't own that. Mark Bayshore LLC owns that. We just use our address. So there's a, it's sort of like a, depends on what your definition of is, depends on what your definition of owns is. But for all intents and purposes, these properties are under Strathmore's control. And until, it seems like until those properties are included in this proposal or are, you know, somehow consolidated with the city properties, there's going to be this problem about how can you redevelop the city lands,
right, piecemeal approach,
without knowing what's going on at these other properties that are currently still Strathmore controlled.
And DTN, I believe, wants to build the walkway across Grand River, if I'm not mistaken, across to Michigan State.
I think there were two proposals that considered a pedestrian walkway, and you know, I'm not sure how East Lansing residents will take to that idea of having a, they might look at the pedway other places and think, maybe not for us.
And there's an important deadline 1 week from today involving the old bank building currently owned by Cata Development involving the foreclosure action there.
And there's going to be a hefty amount of money that's going to have to come due to redeem that property out of foreclosure. Otherwise, it's going to revert to the holder of the loan, which is Rob LLC, another LLC. But there's still some question, you know, some court documents that appear to show that maybe there are some other interests on the property that some people have filed, some other out-of-state companies have filed an interest that would say, if this reverts, then we get a piece of it. So ownership is always a question with these properties. Who owns it? How much do they own? What happens when they stop owning it? It's a quagmire.
I think what happens a week from today is going to be very interesting, too.
Well, lucky so, you and I, we have a standing date to talk about
that's it. That's right, 1 week from today. Angela Whitrock of MLive joins us every Monday on Current State. Thanks, Angela.
Thanks, Mark.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll discuss the latest in the NioWave pole barn dispute. More public comments are expected at tonight's Lansing City Council meeting. Also, a reminder that the Michigan Association of Broadcasters Foundation is holding a broadcast career fair this Wednesday from 1 to 3:30 p.m. at the Lansing Center in downtown Lansing. If you're interested in a career in radio or TV, there will be a number of stations present, including ours, WKAR. To talk with. For more information, mishmab.com/careers. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com.